It is Friday. And every Friday, this terrible urge comes over me. It is an urge which one night I am not going to be able to resist. And it's not quite the urge you think. Ever since I was in seventh grade, I've had a desire because I one time saw a person do it, and that person pulled it off so beautifully and caused that person to become so loved in the entire area where I lived or existed at that time that ever since that time, I've had a terrible desire to sing. I'm on a stage before 1,000 people. The Indian Love Call. Stockbroker James Terry of Daly City, California, celebrating his 44th birthday, had his evening ruined when he found a small foreign car parked so closely behind his automobile that he was inconvenienced in getting his car out. Terry solved his problem with a fire wrench. With a sympathetic crowd of 400 patrons to a nearby art theater on hand, they watched and shouted encouragement. Terry smashed all the windows in the car. He also smashed in the hood and started to work on the driver's side of the vehicle. The spectators shouted, "Hit it again! Hit it again! Go to it!" After smashing the car to bits, Terry got in his motor machine and drove away. The crowd applauded, and silence fell on the street in front of the art theater in San Francisco, California, the city of West Coast culture. So I feel like singing the Indian Love Call. Are there any requests tonight? Oh, the life is just welling up inside of me like a tube of number two toothpaste. That's the number two iodine toothpaste for teeth really hard to clean. And then they have another kind of toothpaste which they sell under the counter for, well, we'll be here until midnight. I'm telling you, sometimes you just can't push it aside. It's like this. I'm sitting there and I'm watching the television today. I'm watching the ball game, and they got this ball game. You know, all the guys are hitting balls around. And it's just fun. You know, it's just interesting. And then all of a sudden, out came the commercial. Well, this commercial was about an automobile. Now, you know as well as I do that automobiles are just not automobiles in our time any longer. They're very much more than that. And don't think for a minute that they're status symbols. They're not status symbols any longer at all. That's what's confused a lot of people. I think if they buy this great big car with the fins, it's going to make them important. But it really doesn't work that way anymore because the car is more than that. I suddenly realized it, Ed. This commercial came on, you know, and it showed this car coming along the road. You didn't see any people at all. You just saw this car just going along. And I'm watching it. I'm very excited. And the car is showing up, and it goes up over the hill, and it comes along. And all of a sudden, the man says, "There goes the 1963 Whoopi-mobile. A confident, aggressive, successful machine. Yes, this car is confident. It's successful. And it is aggressive." And here all along, I thought it was people who were confident. I didn't know that inanimate objects could have confidence. These are little things that people used to have, you know. And things like aggressiveness. I didn't know that a telephone pole, say, for example, which is an inanimate object, could be aggressive. I didn't know that, you see, at that point. And I never once realized, you see, that a typewriter could be a successful typewriter. I suppose, conversely, there are typewriters that are losers, too, just like us. And I kind of like to think, too, that there must be a few cars that are not aggressive at all, but are shy. There must be a few cars around that are a little nervous, too. I'll have to tell you about the nervous car I once owned. Of course, that car, that was before you knew that cars were nervous. All I thought was it had bad tappets. But it was actually a nervous car, I guess, by now. And I'll never forget the time did I ever tell you about the time I knew the aggressive car? Well, I'll tell you about an aggressive car. If you want to hear about an aggressive car, if you think this commercial is going to do it, let me. This is not a commercial. There was this friend of mine named Flick. I've hardly ever talked about Flick. I'm a kid, see. And we're fooling around with cars all the time. We're building, you know, just all kinds of things, working on cars. And one of the greatest cars that I ever saw in my life as a beautiful little machine was a car that I bought in a junkyard for $60. $60 at that time represented the sum total of my life savings going all the way back to the time my uncle gave me the first dollar after he'd sold his first bottle of bootleg scotch. That went all the way back. I mean, I had been saving every nickel, every cent, everything. I had little things like cigar store coupons, everything, all in a big box. And it finally arrived at the point where it was worth $60. Now, that's a lot of money, you know, in those days. $60. I mean, $60 in those days was at least $64 today. A lot of dough. And so I finally located the car that I wanted to buy. And I don't know whether or not you remember the wild excitement that was involved in looking for something that really is important to you. I mean, really important to you. I don't mean the 28th car is really not much. It's like the 44th beautiful chick you've known, you know. It's not quite the same as the first one or the second one, you know. They're not quite the same. Well, anyway, I'm going out. I'm this kid, and I'm looking for this car. Well, I finally found the one I wanted. It was $60. And so me and my kid brother drove the thing home, and it was something, you know. It had bad kingpins and all that, and I started to work on it. And I don't know whether you know what it's like to yourself to replace the kingpins in a car, or whether you know what it's like to drop the pan on a V8, or whether you know what it's like to try to get, even just to try to get to the generator on one of those V8s. That was a real job in itself, you know, way down under the bottom there. And I got so, really, seriously, at one point in my life, I got so that I could, in the dark, in a driving rain, even in a snowstorm, I've even done it in a sandstorm, in the dark, in the rain, in a sandstorm, I could replace, repair, and completely refurbish a fuel pump for a V8. In less than 5 minutes. That is, before the chick in the car got irritated. I could do that fast, you know, before they even started to honk. And I could get out of the car as soon as I felt that little faint flutter. I'm driving along, and I just feel it, you know, that little chug when it's like running out of gas, you know what I mean? Immediately, I turn the key off before it drains all the gas out of the carburetor, out of the car, and I've got one hand, of course. I've got all the stuff out of the glove compartment automatically, you know. I got a new diaphragm, I've got the washer, and I'm out like that, and taking it off the top. I could just feel that. I know how that knurled nut felt right on the top of that fuel pump, the one that sat right down in the middle, you know, between the two banks of cylinders and the V8, you know, the one on the top there, like that. Let me tell you how I used to... Oh, please. Oh, well, anyway, this is all part and parcel of the story. You see, we're getting to the time of the first really aggressive automobile I've ever known, a genuinely aggressive car, a true aggressive machine. And this car, in case you're interested, had at least 45 owners before me, but it had been kept in good condition, beautiful little body. It was a roadster. It was a two-seater with a rumble seat, and it was a 1933 Ford V8. You ever seen the wire wheels? Yellow wire wheels. Lovely little car. In fact, I saw one a couple of weeks ago on an old late movie. Somebody was driving that little V8. It's just a beautiful little beautiful little car. So this thing has got about 45 owners behind it, but I lavished love all the way down to the last valve cap on that thing. Let me tell you, I polished every valve spring I knew by its first name. I really did. Every piston ring in that car I had personally set myself, every one. And every brush in that generator I knew by its first name, and it had been burnt by each one of them. Every last one of them. You know that kind of thing where you knew? Every time I'd know a rattle, I'd know exactly what it was. I'd hop out of there with the thing, take off, back in the car. Had a great roar. You could hear, you could tell. In fact, even today, if you listen carefully, if you sit next to a Ford V8 type, you can tell the characteristic sound of that V8 engine. It has a characteristic sound. Just like that straight six of the Chevrolet has a characteristic sound. I can tell the overhead valve sound of a of a Chevy from at least three blocks off. Seriously. Even with potatoes in my ears, I can just... It's a vibration that it sets up. I don't know what it is. We're machine men, let's face it. So, I got this beautiful little car. And there was this buddy of mine named Flick, who was a wise guy. Flick was, seriously, he was an early... Well, I'll tell you, he was before his time. He would have really made it great if he was a kid at this time. So anyway, Flick, he had big eyes for my little V8. And he would always make disparaging remarks about it. You know, that's one way to get your hands on something that you really want. Have you ever gone out on a double date and some guy really gets a thing on the chick that you're with? You know? And then he starts to tell you rotten things about the chick. And you know something's going, oh, what a bum. What is this chick? What a why? And you find he's starting little arguments with her, you know, while you're sitting there. And you know, and he's ignoring the chick he's with, and he's starting arguments. Come on, what do you mean you put piccalilli on a hot dog? Piccalilli on a hot dog? Oh, for crying out loud. You like piccalilli on a hot dog? You don't even taste a hot dog with a piccalilli on it. And it goes on. And you know that there's about to be something happen. You know it. Secretly, sinisterly, underneath it all, you know that you're ready for a fight. And you're going to lose. Well, Flick had his eyes open, big eyes for my V8, because every time I would show up with my little V8, he'd say, oh, what a tank. What a tank. Well, it developed, and sure enough, one day, Flick says, how'd you like to sell that clunker? Well, I wasn't about to sell the clunker, you see. He says, it's not worth much, but I'd kind of like to fool around a little bit. I'd like to just mess around a little bit. It's a rotten car, of course. What I'm actually looking for is a four-cylinder Plymouth. Ha, 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 can't find any right here. That's a rotten V8. I hate those rotten V8. Burn oil, you know. Ha, ha, rotten. Well, so, you know, he's putting me on the defensive about this. They're fuel pumps, rotten fuel pumps. Terrible. Well, this goes on like that for another couple of months. And finally, it develops that Flick wants to buy a half interest in the car. Since it's obvious I'm not going to sell it. Well, it was the first, the only, and the last time I have ever taken a half interest in anything. You know, there's a great hillbilly song out now called, I'd rather loan you out than lose you, baby. I kind of like that sentiment. It goes something, I'd rather loan you out than lose you, baby. I'm a-sitting here and I'm a-crying tonight. I want to feel your arms around me, a-holding me tight. Well, speaking of, this is WOR AM and FM New York, and we'll be here until midnight. There really is a hillbilly song called I'd Rather Loan You Out Than Lose You. I just kind of like that sentiment. Only in the 1960s, believe me. So I'm working on the car and playing around with it, and one day I did sell for $35 half interest in my V8. Little realizing that I was not only selling half interest in my V8, I was also selling half interest in my life. I was selling out my rights. I was selling out. You know, we sell out all the way down the line, all of us. This is, by the way, one of my educational programs tonight, in case you're interested, how you learn on how not to get euchred. Or, really, seriously, the educational side of the program tonight is how to detect when you've been euchred, which you can do nothing about because man today is already from the beginning, as soon as he emerges, he's euchred, just by the society in which he lives. And that is not American society. That's 20th century society, Dad. We're talking about getting a little bit bigger than that, you know. So it really doesn't make any difference one way or the other. You're not going to fight it. You're not going to win. So you might as well fight it. That's all I could say. It's like this friend of mine. A great remark was made to me the other night. And once in a while, one remark comes whistling over the phone or something that just has to be repeated. I'm going to have to tell you this. This friend of mine was talking to me on the phone. He's the kind that hardly ever says anything like this. And we were discussing a third party, another guy we know. And he says, and I said to him, well, you know, I have evidence to believe that this guy is going through some soul searching. There was a slight pause at the other end of the line. He says, oh, well, he says, look, he can search his soul all he wants to, but he won't find anything. That was great. Then he went on and says, well, yeah, but, you know, he's worried about things. He's really trying to fight. He says, listen, don't worry about him, for crying out loud. Don't worry about that guy. He says, I don't care who he fights, even if it's himself. He's going to come out on top. Well, that states it. He's going to come out on top. So I did not realize at the time when I sold out for $35 that I was not only selling out my rights, I was selling out something very, very much more subtle than that. I was selling part of my dream. And you know, when you start selling parts of your dream, you're really in trouble. What else do you have, actually, in the end, you know? You wind up with bad knees and stuff, but after all, you have a dream. So here I had worked on this thing, and it was just something beautiful in my eyes. Well, the day arrived when I had sold out, and so we were working on a part-time basis. You know, I use the car 3 days a week. You use it another couple of days, Flick. So one day, I came over to get the car. You want to arrive at the denouement. All right, I arrived one day to get the car, and it was over at Flick's house. I go around the back, and I see that the garage is open. And so I assume the car is in the garage, and I hear a lot of stuff going on. I hear banging and whistling and stuff going on in the garage. And I go into the garage, and there it is. The hood is off. It's up on jacks, all four jacks. He's got a great big chain going up to the ceiling. You see, it goes up, you know, with a pulley. And he's got stuff spread out all over. It's all over the floor. He's got gunny sacks with tools. He's got everything all piled. He's got generators laying there. He's got the carburetor up. And I said, Flick, what are you doing? What are you doing, Flick? And I had these beautiful cylinder heads, you know, that I had polished. What are you doing, Flick? And he's underneath, and he's got the chain going up, and I hear him, and he is under there with another guy. I see two sets of feet sticking out of there. And it's Flick, and I says, who's under there with you, Flick? He says, Schwartz. And he says nothing, and I just hear a lot of clunking. I said, what are you guys doing? It's my car, you know. I did not realize that part of my dream. It's as though suddenly a large Kodiak bear selling walnut shells and a pea game arrives in Oz, you know. I mean, this is the place where the wizard is. This is the place where Dorothy and the Cowardly Lion are, you know. They don't have this kind of stuff there. And, you know, it's like a pitch man suddenly arrives on the scene and he's passing them out. And I says, whoa, what are you doing? What are you doing? And he says, I'm putting in another motor. I said, another motor? What are you out of your mind? Well, with that, he comes out from underneath there, and he's all covered with glop. He's covered with oil and grease and crud and stuff, and he's got this big thing. And he tells me, yeah. So I went down to Paswinski's, and he said, you know that old wrecked Buick they had out there in the back? What's the wrecked Buick? They had this great big Buick, what is it, the Roadmaster. They had a big Roadmaster out there that had been wrecked. Somebody had clobbered it and busted the drive shaft, and it was all wrecked, and they were using it to cannibalize, you know, to take out hubcaps and stuff. He said, you know that Buick they had back there, the Roadmaster, the big 8? I said, yeah. He says, well, I bought the motor from them for $14. I said, Flick, you're going to put that Buick Roadmaster in the V8? He said, yeah, I want to make this into a real car. And there I see over in the corner this monster. I don't know whether you know the difference between a little V8, 65 horsepower, and that great big Buick Roadmaster. Straight there was that thing. It stretched. It was like, it looked like an Allison air-cooled jet fighter engine over there. You know, great big fat. I said, it won't go in. He said, I'm strengthening the springs. I got some special shocks, and I'm strengthening the springs, and I also got a frame divider. I said, my car, what are you doing to it? And of course, it was too late. There it was. Everything was out, and he had stuff sawed, and it had been going on for 2 days, and I didn't know it. And I says, I got a date tonight with Dorothy. Says, I'm sorry, Dad. Should have called. I said, but Flick, I've got a date tonight. Of course, I'm trying to bring it back together. Well, to make a long story short, and to make a disgusting story real, this is exactly what happened. Flick worked all weekend. I took Dorothy out on the streetcar that night, and of course, early Sunday morning, I am there like a bird. I want to see what's going on. I'm like, this thing, you know? And I arrived there like a bird, and all I can do is help him. It has gone too far. Have you ever seen things go so far that you got to pitch in? Now, you know, you just give in. All right, they're having a fight, so you don't want to fight. And the next thing you know, you're slugging away and hitting guys with vases and everything. It's just gone too far. You got to fight. It's just like, you know, what must have happened in Hitler's Germany. It had gone too far, so they went, well, what can I do? So you get a job with a gas oven, you know. You just go along. So I am all Sunday putting this thing in this car, and I knew it was an insane thing from the beginning. It was ridiculous, weird, completely out of the question. Well, we worked all day Sunday. We worked till about 2 o'clock in the morning. We had school Monday morning, you know. So school comes Monday morning, and I am sick. I'm already beginning to feel disaster is lurking over the horizon, you know, and I know it now. And so I can hardly wait. I finish school, and I go tearing off over to Flick's house that night, and there we are working again. Well, we worked and worked and worked for one solid week until finally we got that monstrosity in the car. We had to put in another transmission. I want to tell you, we were down at the junkyard looking for a transmission that would fit that awful thing. it was just a nightmare. It was just, I can't describe to you what kind of a nightmare. Nothing fitted, nothing. And then we finally got this thing in, and you should have seen that poor car settle. Have you ever seen a fat lady, after she has had three Thanksgiving dinners, sit down quietly in a hammock? Well, you know, I have seen 4-foot oak trees bend under such a condition. Well, we got this thing down, and we slowly started to lower the jacks, one by one. We're just lowering them down until finally the car is land, and I'm telling you, it was sad. Have you ever seen a knock-kneed 3-year-old kid? Well, the wheels were tilted out. This thing was laying down there, and it was just sort of leaning forward. It was one of them. And then you put your foot back in again. You let it go. And then you finally ease it in, and it's going. And then she's whistling down the street. And you shift it in a second. You didn't need second. You know. And all the while it would go, the car would roll. It would roll because of excess power. Excess power. Terrible overbalance. Understaffed, undermanned, overbalanced, overpowered, and it would just roll. And you know what happened then? About the third or fourth day, I absolutely hate that automobile. I hated it. And I had loved this car before. I hated that machine. I've never else, ever in my life, really hated an inanimate object. But I think now, at this point, I can understand why I hated it. I wasn't hating the car itself. I was hating this piece of a dream or something. I can't call it a dream. Maybe it was a dream. I don't know what it was. Something that I had sold. Something that no longer was real or right or something. And I would get into this car, and I hated it. I just hated it. And after we worked on it a while, Paswinski and all the guys worked on it, it got so you could really get it going. It could go, you know. But I just couldn't stand it. I hated this machine. And it was a funny thing, too, because Flick got so that he didn't like it either. And, you know, we never used the car then. The car would sit in back of Flick's house or would sit in back of my house, and once in a while, a couple of days a week, maybe we'd take it out a little bit. You know, somebody's got to go to the store, or some guy's got to go to Calumet City or someplace, and you'd get in the car and you drive it. But there was none of this stuff anymore, you know, of just going out in the car, just playing around, just going out. And one day, I'm sitting in study hall, and Flick is in there in the study hall with me, and he's all excited. And he goes, oh, and he says, hey, Shep. And I said, what, Flick? He says, hey, Josway wants to buy the Ford. I said, no kidding. He says, yeah, we can unload it. I said, how much? He says, well, I've got him up to 50. I said, get it, quick. Is it cash? He says, yep, he's ready to do it this afternoon. I said, for crying out loud, don't let him out of your sight. And there's Joshua. He's sitting about three tables over there, sitting there, you know, looking very self-satisfied behind his geography books. And I says, get it, quick, get the dough, get the dough, get the dough, get the dough. Don't tell him, get the dough. And I'm sitting there, and suddenly I'm just filled with this wild just a tremendous exaltation, terrific exaltation. And I didn't realize it at that time that it was nothing, it had nothing to do with the car. And Flick is sitting down there at the other end of the table, and he's kind of, you know, grubbing around trying to pretend he's interested in algebra and so on. And immediately after the period, we grab Joshua. We grab him down on the gym and say, you want to buy the car? Well, actually, we're not really thinking of selling, you know. It's a real good car. You know, we've worked over. We got a Buick. It's got a Roadmaster engine in it, boy. A straight eight Roadmaster engine. And let me tell you, it's got an oversized transmission and a rotten car. We're not planning to sell it. It's a great car. And, of course, we're all through. And Al says, all right, I want to buy it. $50, no more. Well, $50. Well, to make a long story even shorter, that night I am in Joshua's kitchen, and Mrs. Josaway and old man Josaway and all are watching the transaction. I am afraid that any minute now it is going to be halted. You know, whenever mamas and papas get in, people start blowing whistles. And I'm standing, and I'll never forget, they even had a big blue checkered linoleum. It was the first people I ever knew who had a totally linoleum-covered house. They had linoleum in the living room. You ever known people that had linoleum in the living room everywhere? Well, I had never seen anything like this. See, and I always liked to go to Josway's place because the only place you could roller skate, even in the, you know, in and out the John, everywhere, you could roller skate in this house. So we would do it, too, actually. So Josaway is in the kitchen, and I'm there with Mrs. Joshua and the old man, and he's actually giving us, and both of us, me and Flick, are sitting there, just, actually, you know, Mr. Josaway, it's a great car. We didn't want to sell it, you know. You know, Mr. Anderson was here the other day, was asking us about buying it. We told him no, but actually, you know, of course, Al's an old friend of ours, and we figure, and we're getting the dough, and this is what happened. I reach in, I've got the title, you know, and the whole business. I sign it over in Indiana. You just sign the title. That's all I signed. It was made out to me, you know. I signed it. I got the $50. Flick and I were out of that house in 4 milliseconds. 5 minutes later, we are a mile and a half away and heading towards George's Cigar Store, where we're going to split the loot. We get down there, and I give Flick $25. I got $25, and I go home. And I go into the house, and my mother, of course, she could see right away there was a funny look on my face. She says, "What's the matter? What happened to you?" She figured, you know, she knew that something was going to happen one day with me and Dorothy Anderson. She figured this was the day. You see? And I came in with this wild look in my eyes, you know. Oh, boy. And she says, what's with you anyway? Come on, what's the matter? Sit down here. What is it now? What is it? And she's going, you know, she's heading towards the phone. She's going to call Mrs. Anderson right away. And I says, oh boy. She says, what did you do? Now, come on, what did you do? She said, I won't tell your father. Now, what did you do? I said, I sold the Ford. She said, you what? She had remembered that I had saved 400 years for this Ford, you see. And you know, there's a funny thing about a dream that's been spoiled. You hardly ever tell it to anybody. She did not know that my dream had gone out the window. To her, she thought this would be a disaster that I had sold the Ford. She didn't understand it. She said, well, I thought, you know, you saved like 9 years for the car. What's the matter? I said, oh, boy. Oh, boy. She said, how much did you get? I said, $25. Oh, boy, $25. She said, but you paid $60 for that car. You broke your fingernails for 2 years on that thing. I said, $25. $25. I got the 25. I'm going to start all over again, Mom. All over again. Clean slate. Clean slate. I've been looking at that. I've been looking at a Model A. Model A, you know, down at Feldman's. There's a Model A down there. She says, $25 you got for your... I am going... $25. If your father ever hears that you got $25 on that car, he's really going to go out of his mind. Because, you know, this was like I had lost $40 or something just overnight. But she never understood it. And my kid brother thought I was a nut for selling that car. He came home and he said, you sold the car for $25. And, of course, the word immediately got to my old man. And my old man spent 3 hours that night talking to me in the sun parlor, telling me about what money meant. He says, now I'm going to tell you what money means. I'm going to tell you what money means. Money doesn't come easy, kid. Do you know how long it takes me to earn a dollar? Do you know how long it takes me to earn $20? Do you know how long it took Mr. Bruner to earn enough money to buy Junior Bruner's breakfast yesterday? I knew Mr. Bruner had not worked for 4 straight years. You have just lost $35. And he's getting madder and madder because obviously I was getting happier and happier as he talked, because all I could think of was that I had gotten rid of this terrible thing, this awful thing that turned into something terrible. It used to growl at me at night when I'd come out and look at it. It snapped. It growled. I got $25, Dad. It's going to be different again.
Pare bole,
Well, I'll tell you, I learned something there that I have never forgotten. You know, it's a funny thing. I guess the little feelings that most of us have today. You know what I think is the matter with America today? Just that. Just exactly that. I suspect that the awful feeling that you have that something hasn't worked out right, something, and you can't quite put your fingers on it, that has to do with either selling or losing or disseminating or maybe even wantonly breaking something which you once held and which once meant it, and you know that it'll never come back. You know what I mean? You know, America's very different than it used to be. I'm sure you know that. It's very different, and at the same time, it's the same, just like that V8. It was very different, but very much the same. And on the one hand, you love it, and on the other hand, you can't stand it. You don't know which way it's going to go.